Listen up, football fans. You won't want to miss this.
Right now, new Bet365 customers bet $5 and get $300 in bonus bets, win or lose. So you could turn that $300 into something bigger when you bet on money lines, spread, totals, player props.
$300 in bonus bets when new customers bet $5. I know where I'm going to bet from now on. Download the app today and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365.
Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply. In-app only.
With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood. Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC, member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.
Chapter 1, Where Angels Fear to Tread. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. To find out more or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Where Angels Fear to Tread by E. M. Forster. Chapter 1. They were all at Charing Cross to see Lilia off. Philip, Harriet, Irma, Mrs. Harrington herself. Even Mrs. Theobald, squired by Mr. Kingcroft, had braved the journey from Yorkshire to bid her only daughter goodbye. Miss Abbott was likewise attended by numerous relatives, and the sight of so many people talking at once and saying such different things caused Lilia to break into ungovernable peals of laughter. "Quite an ovation!" she cried, sprawling out of her first-class carriage. "They'll take us for royalty. Oh, Mr. Kingcroft, get us foot-warmers!" The good-natured young man hurried away, and Philip, taking his place, flooded her with a final stream of advice and injunctions. Where to stop, how to learn Italian, when to use mosquito nets, what pictures to look at. Remember, he concluded, that it is only by going off the track that you get to know the country. See the little towns, Gubbio, Pienza, Cortona, San Gemignano, Monteriano. And don't, let me beg you, go with that awful tourist idea that Italy is only a museum of antiquities and art. Love and understand the Italians, for the people are more marvelous than the land.
"How I wish you were coming, Philip," she said, flattered at the unwonted notice her brother-in-law was giving her.
"I wish I were." He could have managed it without great difficulty, for his career at the bar was not so intense as to prevent occasional holidays. But his family disliked his continual visits to the continent. He himself often found pleasure in the idea that he was too busy to leave town. "Good-bye, dear everyone. What a whirl!" She caught sight of her little daughter Irma, and felt that a touch of maternal solemnity was required. "Good-bye, darling. Mind you're always good, and do what Granny tells you." She referred not to her own mother, but to her mother-in-law, Mrs. Harrington, who hated the title of Granny. Irma lifted a serious face to be kissed, and said cautiously, "I'll do my best." "She is sure to be good," said Mrs. Harrington, who was standing pensively a little out of the hubbub. But Lilia was already calling to Miss Abbott, a tall, grave, rather nice-looking young lady, who was conducting her adieus in a more decorous manner on the platform.
"Caroline, my Caroline! Jump in, or your chaperone will go off without you."
And Philip, whom the idea of Italy always intoxicated, had started again, telling her of the supreme moments of her coming journey, the Campanile of Airolo, which would burst on her when she emerged from the St. Gothard tunnel, presaging the future, the view of the Ticino and Lago Maggiore as the train climbed up the slopes of Monte Ceneri, the view of Lugano, the view of Como, Italy gathering thick around her now, the arrival at her first resting place, when, after long driving through dark and dirty streets, she should at last behold, amid the roar of trams and the glare of arc lamps, the buttresses of the Cathedral of Milan.
"Handkerchiefs and collars!" screamed Harriet. "In my inlaid box! I've lent you my inlaid box!"
"Good old Harry!" She kissed everyone again, and there was a moment's silence. They all smiled steadily, excepting Philip, who was choking in the fog, and old Mrs. Theobald, who had begun to cry. Miss Abbott got into the carriage. The guard himself shut the door and told Lilia that she would be all right. Then the train moved, and they all moved with it a couple of steps and waved their handkerchiefs and uttered cheerful little cries. At that moment Mr. Kingcroft reappeared, carrying a foot-warmer by both ends, as if it was a tea-tray. He was sorry that he was too late, and called out in a quivering voice, "Good-bye, Mrs. Charles. May you enjoy yourself, and may God bless you."
Lilia smiled and nodded, and then the absurd position of the foot-warmer overcame her, and she began to laugh again. "Oh, I am so sorry," she cried back, "but you do look so funny. Oh, you all look so funny waving. Oh, pray!" And laughing helplessly, she was carried out into the fog. "High spirits to begin so long a journey," said Mrs. Theobald, dabbing her eyes. Mr. Kingcroft solemnly moved his head in token of agreement. "I wish," said he, "that Mrs. Charles had gotten the foot-warmer. These London porters won't take heed to a country chap." "But you did your best," said Mrs. Herriton, "and I think it simply noble of you to have brought Mrs. Theobald all the way here on such a day as this." Then, rather hastily, she shook hands and left him to take Mrs. Theobald all the way back. Sawston, her own home, was within easy reach of London, and they were not late for tea. Tea was in the dining-room, with an egg for Irma to keep up the child's spirits. The house seemed strangely quiet after a fortnight's bustle, and their conversation was spasmodic and subdued. They wondered whether the travellers had got to Folkestone, whether it would be at all rough, and if so, what would happen to poor Miss Abbott. "And Granny, when will the old ship get to Italy?" asked Irma. "Grandmother, dear, not Granny," said Mrs. Herriton, giving her a kiss. "And we say a boat or a steamer, not a ship. Ships have sails. And Mother won't go all the way by sea. You look at the map of Europe, and you'll see why. Harriet, take her. Go with Aunt Harriet, and she'll show you the map." "Right-o," said the little girl, and dragged the reluctant Harriet into the library. Mrs. Herriton and her son were left alone. There was immediately confidence between them. "Here beginneth the new life," said Philip. "Poor child, how vulgar," murmured Mrs. Herriton. "It's surprising that she isn't worse, but she has got a look of poor Charles about her. And alas, alas, a look of old Mrs. Theobald. What appalling apparition was that? I did think the lady was bedridden as well as imbecile. Why ever did she come?" "Mr. Kingcroft made her. I am certain of it. He wanted to see Lilia again, and this was the only way." "I hope he is satisfied. I did not think my sister-in-law distinguished herself in her farewells." Mrs. Herriton shuddered. "I mind nothing, so long as she is gone, and gone with Miss Abbott. It is mortifying to think that a widow of 33 requires a girl 10 years younger to look after her." "I pity Miss Abbott. Fortunately, one admirer is chained to England. Mr. Kingcroft cannot leave the crops or the climate or something. I don't think either he improved his chances today. He, as well as Lilia, has the knack of being absurd in public." Mrs. Herriton replied, "When a man is neither well-bred, nor well-connected, nor handsome, nor clever, nor rich, even Lilia may discard him in time." "No, I believe she would take anyone. Right up to the last, when her boxes were packed, she was playing the chinless curate. Both the curates are chinless, but hers had the dampest hands. I came on them in the park. They were speaking of the Pentateuch. My dear boy, if possible, she has got worse and worse. It was your idea of Italian travel that saved us." Philip brightened at the little compliment. "The odd part is that she was quite eager, always asking me for information, and of course I was very glad to give it. I admit she is a Philistine, appallingly ignorant, and her taste in art is false. Still, to have any taste at all is something, and I do believe that Italy really purifies and ennobles all who visit her. She is the school as well as the playground of the world. It is really to Lilia's credit that she wants to go there." "She would go anywhere," said his mother, who had heard enough of the praises of Italy. "I and Caroline Abbott had the greatest difficulty in dissuading her from the Riviera." "No, mother, no. She was really keen on Italy. This travel is quite a crisis for her." He found the situation full of whimsical romance. There was something half attractive, half repellent in the thought of this vulgar woman journeying to places he loved and revered. Why should she not be transfigured? The same had happened to the Goths. Mrs. Herriton did not believe in romance, nor in transfiguration, nor in parallels from history, nor in anything else that may disturb domestic life. She adroitly changed the subject before Philip got excited. Soon Harriet returned, having given her lesson in geography. Irma went to bed early and was tucked up by her grandmother. Then the two ladies worked and played cards. Philip read a book. And so they all settled down to their quiet, profitable existence, and continued it without interruption through the winter. It was now nearly 10 years since Charles had fallen in love with Lilia Theobald, because she was pretty, and during that time Mrs. Herriton had hardly known a moment's rest. For 6 months she schemed to prevent the match. and when it had taken place, she turned to another task, the supervision of her daughter-in-law. Lilia must be pushed through life without bringing discredit on the family into which she had married. She was aided by Charles, by her daughter Harriet, and as soon as he was old enough, by the clever one of the family, Philip. The birth of Irma made things still more difficult. But fortunately old Mrs. Theobald, who had attempted interference, began to break up. It was an effort to her to leave Whitby, and Mrs. Herriton discouraged the effort as far as possible. That curious duel which is fought over every baby was fought and decided early. Irma belonged to her father's family, not her mother's. Charles died, and the struggle recommenced. Lilia tried to assert herself, and said that she should go to take care of Mrs. Theobald. It required all Mrs. Herriton's kindness to prevent her. A house was finally taken for her at Sawston, and there for 3 years she lived with Irma, continually subject to the refining influences of her late husband's family. During one of her rare Yorkshire visits, trouble began again. Lilia confided to a friend that she liked a Mr. Kingcroft extremely, but that she was not exactly engaged to him. The news came round to Mrs. Herriton, who at once wrote, begging for information, pointing out that Lilia must either be engaged or not, since no intermediate state existed. It was a good letter, and flurried Lilia extremely. She left Mr. Kingcroft without even the pressure of a rescue party. She cried a great deal on her return to Sawston, and said she was very sorry. Mrs. Herriton took the opportunity of speaking more seriously about the duties of widowhood and motherhood than she had ever done before. But somehow things never went easily after. Lilia would not settle down in her place among Sawston matrons. She was a bad housekeeper, always in the throes of some domestic crisis, which Mrs. Herriton, who kept her servants for years, had to step across and adjust. She let Irma stop away from school for insufficient reasons, and she allowed her to wear rings. She learned to bicycle for the purpose of waking the place up, and coasted down the high street one Sunday morning, falling off at the turn by the church. If she had not been a relative, it would have been entertaining. But even Philip, who in theory loved outraging English conventions, rose to the occasion, and gave her a talking which she remembered to her dying day. It was just then, too, that they discovered that she still allowed Mr. Kingcroft to write to her, as a gentleman friend, and to send presents to Irma. Philip thought of Italy, and the situation was saved. Caroline, charming, sober Caroline Abbott, who lived two turnings away, was seeking a companion for a year's travel. Lilia gave up her house, sold half her furniture, left the other half in Irma with Mrs. Herriton, and had now departed, amid universal approval, for a change of scene. She wrote to them frequently during the winter, more frequently than she wrote to her mother. Her letters were always prosperous. Florence she found perfectly sweet, Naples a dream but very whiffy, and Rome went hence simply to sit still and feel. Philip, however, declared that she was improving. He was particularly gratified when in the early spring she began to visit the smaller towns that he had recommended. "In a place like this," she wrote, "one really does feel in the heart of things and off the beaten track. Looking out of a Gothic window every morning, it seems impossible that the Middle Ages have passed away." The letter was from Monteriano, and concluded with a not unsuccessful description of the wonderful little town. "It is something that she is contented," said Mrs. Herriton, "but no one could live 3 months with Caroline Abbott and not be the better for it." Just then Irma came in from school, and she read her mother's letter to her, carefully correcting any grammatical errors, for she was a loyal supporter of parental authority. Irma listened politely, but soon changed the subject to hockey, in which her whole being was absorbed. They were to vote for colors that afternoon. Yellow and white, or yellow and green? What did her grandmother think? Of course Mrs. Herriton had an opinion, which she sedately expounded, in spite of Harriet, who said that colors were unnecessary for children, and of Philip, who said that they were ugly. She was getting proud of Irma, who had certainly greatly improved, and could no longer be called that most appalling of things, a vulgar child. She was anxious to form her before her mother returned. So she had no objection to the leisurely movements of the travelers, and even suggested that they should overstay their year if it suited them. Lilia's next letter was also from Monteriano, and Philip grew quite enthusiastic. "They stopped there over a week," he cried. "Why, I shouldn't have done as much myself. They must be really keen, for the hotel's none too comfortable." "I cannot understand people," said Harriet. "What can they be doing all day? And there is no church there, I suppose." There is Santa Deodata, one of the most beautiful churches in Italy. Of course I mean an English church, said Harriet stiffly. Lilia promised me that she would always be in a large town on Sundays. If she goes to a service at Santa Deodata's, she will find more beauty and sincerity than there is in all the back kitchens of Europe. The back kitchen was his nickname for St. James's, a small, depressing edifice much patronized by his sister. She always resented any slight on it, and Mrs. Herriton had to intervene. Now, dears, don't. Listen to Lilia's letter. We love this place, and I do not know how I shall ever thank Philip for telling me it. It is not only so quaint, but one sees the Italians unspoiled in all their simplicity and charm here. The frescoes are wonderful. Caroline, who grows sweeter every day, is very busy sketching. Everyone to his taste, said Harriet, who always delivered a platitude as if it was an epigram. She was curiously virulent about Italy, which she had never visited, her only experience of the continent being an occasional 6 weeks in the Protestant parts of Switzerland. "Oh, Harriet is a bad lot," said Philip as soon as she left the room. His mother laughed and told him not to be naughty, and the appearance of Irma just off to school prevented further discussion, not only in tracts as a child a peacemaker. "One moment, Irma," said her uncle. "I'm going to the station. I'll give you the pleasure of my company." They started together. Irma was gratified, but conversation flagged, for Philip had not the art of talking to the young. Mrs. Herriton sat a little longer at the breakfast-table, re-reading Lilia's letter. Then she helped the cook to clear, order dinner, and started the housemaid turning out the drawing-room, Tuesday being its day. The weather was lovely, and she thought she would do a little gardening, as it was quite early. She called Harriet, who had recovered from the insult to St. James's, and together they went to the kitchen garden and began to sow some early vegetables. "We will save the peas to the last. They are the greatest fun," said Mrs. Herriton, who had the gift of making work a treat. She and her elderly daughter always got on very well, though they had not a great deal in common. Harriet's education had been almost too successful. As Philip once said, she had bolted all the cardinal virtues and couldn't digest them. Though pious and patriotic and a great moral asset for the house, she lacked that pliancy and tact which her mother had much valued, and had expected her to pick up for herself. Harriet, if she had been allowed, would have driven Lilia to an open rupture, and what was worse, she would have done the same to Philip 2 years before, when he returned full of passion for Italy and ridiculing Sawston and its ways. "It's a shame, mother," she had cried. "Philip laughs at everything, the book club, the debating society, the progressive whist, the bazaars. People won't like it. We have our reputation. A house divided against itself cannot stand." Mrs. Herriton replied in the memorable words, "Let Philip say what he likes, and he will let us do what we like," and Harriet had acquiesced. They sowed the duller vegetables first, and a pleasant feeling of righteous fatigue stole over them as they addressed themselves to the peas. Harriet stretched a string to guide the row straight, and Mrs. Herriton scratched a furrow with a pointed stick. At the end of it she looked at her watch. "It's 12, the second post's in. Run and see if there are any letters." Harriet did not want to go. "Let's finish the peas. There won't be any letters." "No, dear, please go. I'll sow the peas, but you shall cover them up, and mind the birds don't see 'em." Mrs. Herriton was very careful to let those peas trickle evenly from her hand, and at the end of the row she was conscious that she had never sown better. They were expensive, too. "Actually, old Mrs. Theobald," said Harriet, returning. "Read me the letter. My hands are dirty. How intolerable the crusted paper is." Harriet opened the envelope. "I don't understand," she said. "It doesn't make sense." Her letters never did. "But it must be sillier than usual," said Harriet, and her voice began to quaver. "Look here, read it, mother. I can't make head or tail." Mrs. Herriton took the letter indulgently. "What is the difficulty?" she said after a long pause. "What is it that puzzles you in this letter?" "The meaning," faltered Harriet. The sparrows hopped nearer and began to eye the peas. "The meaning is quite clear. Lilia is engaged to be married." "Don't cry, dear. Please me by not crying. Don't talk at all. It's more than I could bear. She is going to marry someone she has met in a hotel. Take the letter and read for yourself." Suddenly she broke down over what might seem a small point. "How dare she not tell me direct? How dare she write first to Yorkshire? Pray, am I to hear through Mrs. Theobald a patronizing, insolent letter like this? Have I no claim at all?" "Bear witness, dear," she choked with passion. bear witness that for this I'll never forgive her." "Oh, what is to be done?" moaned Harriet. "What is to be done?" "This first." She tore the letter into little pieces and scattered it over the mold. "Next, a telegram for Lilia. No, a telegram for Miss Caroline Abbott. She, too, has something to explain." "Oh, what is to be done?" repeated Harriet as she followed her mother to the house. She was helpless before such effrontery. What awful thing, what awful person had come to Lilia? Someone in the hotel. The letter only said that. What kind of person? A gentleman? An Englishman? The letter did not say. "Wire reason of stay at Monteriano. Strange rumors," read Mrs. Harrington, and addressed the telegram to Abbott. "Stella d'Italia, Monteriano, Italy. If there is an office there," she added, "we might get an answer this evening. Since Philip is back at 7 and the 8:15 catches the midnight boat at Dover, Harriet, when you go with this, get £100 in 5-pound notes at the bank. Go, dear, at once. Do not talk. I see Irma coming back. Go quickly." "Well, Irma, dear, and whose team are you in this afternoon's, Miss Edith or Miss May's?" But as soon as she had behaved as usual to her granddaughter, she went to the library and took out the large atlas, for she wanted to know about Monteriano. The name was in the smallest print, in the midst of a woolly brown tangle of hills which were called the Sub-Apennines. It was not so very far from Siena, which she had learnt at school. Past it there wandered a thin black line, notched at intervals like a saw, and she knew that this was a railway. But the map left a good deal to imagination, and she had not got any. She looked up the place in Childe Harold, but Byron had not been there. Nor did Mark Twain visit it in The Tramp Abroad. The resources of literature were exhausted. She must wait till Philip came home. And the thought of Philip made her try Philip's room, and there she found Central Italy by Baedeker, and opened it for the first time in her life, and read in it as follows. Monteriano. Population 4,800. Hotels. Stella d'Italia, moderate only. Globo, dirty. Café Garibaldi. Post and telegraph office in Corso Vittorio Emanuele, next to theater. Photographs at Seghena's, cheaper in Florence. Diligence, 1 lira, meets principal trains. Chief attractions, 2 to 3 hours. Santa Deodata, Palazzo Pubblico, Santo Agostino, Santa Caterina, Santa Brogio, Palazzo Capocci. Guide, 2 lira, unnecessary. A walk round the walls should on no account be omitted. The view from the Rocca, small gratuity, is finest at sunset. History, Monteriano, the Mons Rianus of antiquity, whose Ghibelline tendencies are noted by Dante, Purg, 20, definitely emancipated itself from Poggibonsi in 1261. Hence the distich, Poggibonsi fatti in la che Monteriano si fa città, to recently inscribed over the Siena gate. It remained independent till 1530, when it was sacked by the papal troops and became part of the Grand Duchy of Tuscany. It is now of small importance and seat of the district prison. The inhabitants are still noted for their agreeable manners. The traveller will proceed direct from the Siena gate to the collegiate church of Santa Deodata and inspect, fifth chapel on right, the charming frescoes. Mrs. Harrington did not proceed. She was not one to detect the hidden charms of Baedeker. Some of the information seemed to her unnecessary. All of it was dull. Whereas Philip could never read, the view from the Rocca, small gratuity, is finest at sunset, without a catching at the heart. Restoring the book to its place, she went downstairs and looked up and down the asphalt paths for her daughter. She saw her at last 2 turnings away, vainly trying to shake off Mr. Abbott, Miss Caroline Abbott's father. Harriet was always unfortunate. At last she returned, hot, agitated, crackling with banknotes, and Irma bounced to greet her and trod heavily on her corn. "Your feet grow larger every day," said the agonized Harriet, and gave her niece a violent push. Then Irma cried, and Mrs. Harrington was annoyed with Harriet for betraying irritation. Lunch was nasty, and during pudding news arrived that the cook, by sheer dexterity, had broken a very vital knob off the kitchen range. "It is too bad," said Mrs. Harrington. Irma said it was 3 bad, and was told not to be rude. After lunch, Harriet would get out Baedeker and read in injured tones about Monteriano, the Mons Rianus of antiquity, till her mother stopped her. "It's ridiculous to read, dear. She's not trying to marry anyone in the place. Some tourist, obviously, who's stopping in the hotel. The place has nothing to do with it at all." "But what a place to go to! What nice person, too, do you meet in a hotel? Nice or nasty, as I have told you several times before, is not the point. Lilia has insulted our family, and she shall suffer for it. And when you speak against hotels, I think you forget that I met your father at Chamonix. You can contribute nothing, dear, at present, and I think you better hold your tongue. I am going to the kitchen to speak about the range. She spoke just too much, and the cook said that if she could not give satisfaction, she had better leave. A small thing at hand is greater than a great thing remote, and Lilia, misconducting herself upon a mountain in central Italy, was immediately hidden. Mrs. Herriton flew to a registry office, failed, flew to another, failed again, came home, was told by the housemaid that things seemed so unsettled that she had better leave as well. Had tea, wrote 6 letters, was interrupted by cook and housemaid, both weeping, asking her pardon, and imploring to be taken back. In the flush of victory, the doorbell rang, and there was the telegram. Lilia engaged to Italian nobility, writing, Abbott. No answer, said Mrs. Herriton. Get now Mr. Phillips Gladstone from the attic. She would not allow herself to be frightened by the unknown. Indeed, she knew a little now. The man was not an Italian noble. Otherwise the telegram would have said so. It must have been written by Lilia. None but she would have been guilty of the fatuous vulgarity of Italian nobility. She recalled phrases of this morning's letter. We love this place. Caroline is sweeter than ever and busy sketching. Italians full of simplicity and charm. And the remark of Baedeker. The inhabitants are still noted for their agreeable manners, had a baleful meaning now. If Mrs. Herriton had no imagination, she had intuition, a more useful quality, and the picture she made to herself of Lilia's fiancé did not prove altogether wrong. So Philip was received with the news that he must start in 30 minutes for Monteriano. He was in a painful position. For 3 years he had sung the praises of the Italians, but he had never contemplated having one as a relative. He tried to soften the thing down to his mother, but in his heart of hearts he agreed with her when she said, "The man may be a duke, or he may be an organ grinder. That is not the point. If Lilia marries him, she insults the memory of Charles. She insults Irma. She insults us. Therefore, I forbid her, and if she disobeys, we have done with her forever." "I will do all I can," said Philip in a low voice. It was the first time he had had anything to do. Kissed his mother and sister and puzzled Irma. The hall was warm and attractive as he looked back into it from the cold March night, and he departed for Italy reluctantly, as for something commonplace and dull. Before Mrs. Herriton went to bed, she wrote to Mrs. Theobald, using plain language about Lilia's conduct, and hinting that it was a question on which everyone must definitely choose sides. She added, as if it was an afterthought, that Mrs. Theobald's letter had arrived that morning. Just as she was going upstairs, she remembered that she had never covered up those peas. It upset her more than anything, and again she struck the banisters with vexation. Late as it was, she got a lantern from the tool shed and went down the garden to rake the earth over them. The sparrows had taken every one, but countless fragments of the letter remained, disfiguring the tidy ground. That was Chapter 1, Where Angels Fear to Tread, by E. M. Forster.
Chapter 2. Where Angels Fear to Tread, by E. M. Forster. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. To find out more, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Where Angels Fear to Tread, by E. M. Forster. Chapter 2. When the bewildered tourist alights at the station of Monteriano, he finds himself in the middle of the country. There are a few houses round the railway, and many more dotted over the plain and the slopes of the hills, but of a town, medieval or otherwise, not the slightest sign. He must take what is suitably termed el legno, a piece of wood, and drive up 8 miles of excellent road into the Middle Ages. For it is impossible, as well as sacrilegious, to be as quick as Baedeker. It was 3 in the afternoon when Philip left the realms of common sense. He was so weary with travelling that he had fallen asleep in the train. His fellow passengers had the usual Italian gift of divination, and when Monteriano came they knew he wanted to go there, and dropped him out. His feet sank into the hot asphalt of the platform, and in a dream he watched the train depart, while the porter who ought to have been carrying his bag ran up the line playing touch you last with the guard. Alas, he was in no humour for Italy. bargaining for a legno bored him unutterably. The man asked 6 lire, and though Philip knew that for 8 miles it should scarcely be more than 4, yet he was about to give what he was asked, and so make the man discontented and unhappy for the rest of the day. He was saved from this social blunder by loud shouts, and looking up the road saw one cracking his whip and waving his reins, and driving 2 horses furiously, and behind him there appeared the swaying figure of a woman, holding starfish fashion onto anything she could touch. It was Miss Abbott, who had just received his letter from Milan, announcing the time of his arrival, and had hurried down to meet him. He had known Miss Abbott for years, and had never had much opinion about her one way or the other. She was good, quiet, dull, and amiable, and young only because she was 23. There was nothing in her appearance or manner to suggest the fire of youth. All her life had been spent at Sawston with a dull and amiable father, and her pleasant, pallid face, bent on some respectable charity, was a familiar object of the Sawston streets. Why she had ever wished to leave them was surprising. But as she truly said, "I am John Bull to the backbone, yet I do want to see Italy just once. Everybody says it's marvelous, and that one gets no idea of it from books at all." The curate suggested that a year was a long time, and Miss Abbott, with decorous playfulness, answered him, "Oh, but you must let me have my fling. I promise to have it once and once only. It will give me things to think about and talk about for the rest of my life." The curate had consented, so had Mr. Abbott, and here she was in a legno, solitary, dusty, frightened, with as much to answer and to answer for as the most dashing adventuress could desire. They shook hands without speaking. She made room for Philip and his luggage, amidst the loud indignation of the unsuccessful driver, whom it required the combined eloquence of the station-master and the station-beggar to confute. The silence was prolonged until they started. For 3 days he had been considering what he should do, and still more what he should say. He had invented a dozen imaginary conversations, in all of which his logic and eloquence procured him certain victory. But how to begin? He was in the enemy's country, and everything, the hot sun, the cold air behind the heat, the endless rows of olive trees, regular yet mysterious, seemed hostile to the placid atmosphere of Sawston in which his thoughts took birth. At the outset he made one great concession. If the match was really suitable, and Lilia were bent on it, he would give in, and trust to his influence with his mother to set things right. He would not have made the concession in England, but here in Italy, Lilia, however willful and silly, was at all events growing to be a human being. "Are we to talk it over now?" he asked. "Certainly, please," said Miss Abbott in great agitation, "if you will be so very kind." "Then how long has she been engaged?" Her face was that of a perfect fool, a fool in terror. "A short time, quite a short time," she stammered, as if the shortness of the time would reassure him. "I should like to know how long, if you can remember." She entered into elaborate calculations on her fingers. "Exactly 11 days," she said at last. "How long have you been here?" More calculations, while he tapped irritably with his foot. "Close on 3 weeks." "Did you know him before you came?" "No." "Oh, who is he?" "A native of the place." The second silence took place. They had left the plain now and were climbing up the outposts of the hills, the olive trees still accompanying. The driver, a jolly fat man, had got out to ease the horses and was walking by the side of the carriage. "I understood they met at the hotel. It was a mistake of Mrs. Theobald's." "I also understand that he is a member of the Italian nobility." She did not reply. "May I be told his name?" Miss Abbott whispered, "Carella." But the driver heard her, and a grin split over his face. The engagement must be known already. "Carella? Conte or Marchese or what?" "Signor," said Miss Abbott, and looked helplessly aside. "Perhaps I bore you with these questions. If so, I will stop." "Oh, no, please, not at all. I am here, my own idea, to give all information which you very naturally... and to see if somehow... Please ask anything you like." "Then how old is he?" "Oh, quite young. 21, I believe." There burst from Philip the exclamation, "Good Lord!" "One would never believe it," said Miss Abbott, flushing. "He looks much older." "And is he good-looking?" he asked with gathering sarcasm. She became decisive. Very good-looking. All his features are good, and he is well-built, though I dare say English standards would find him too short. Philip, whose one physical advantage was his height, felt annoyed at her implied indifference to it. "May I conclude that you like him?" she replied decisively again. "As far as I have seen him, I do." At that moment the carriage entered a little wood, which lay brown and sombre across the cultivated hill. The trees of the wood were small and leafless, but noticeable for this, that their stems stood in violets as rocks stand in the summer sea. There are such violets in England, but not many. Nor are there so many in art, for no painter has the courage. The cart ruts were channels, the hollow lagoons. Even the dry white margin of the road was splashed like a causeway soon to be submerged under the advancing tide of spring. Philip paid no attention at the time. He was thinking what to say next. But his eyes had registered the beauty, and next March he did not forget that the road to Monteriano must traverse innumerable flowers. "As far as I have seen him, I do like him," repeated Miss Abbott after a pause. He thought she sounded a little defiant, and crushed her at once. "What is he, please? You haven't told me that. What's his position?" She opened her mouth to speak, and no sound came from it. Philip waited patiently. She tried to be audacious, and failed pitiably. "No position at all. He is kicking his heels, as my father would say. You see, he has only just finished his military service." "As a private?" "I suppose so. There is general conscription. He was in the Bersaglieri, I think. Isn't that the crack regiment? The men in it must be short and broad. They must also be able to walk 6 miles an hour." She looked at him wildly, not understanding all that he said, but feeling that he was very clever. Then she continued her defense of Signor Carella. "And now, like most young men, he is out looking for something to do. Meanwhile, like most young men, he lives with his people, father, mother, two sisters, and a tiny tot of a brother." There was a grating sprightliness about her that drove him nearly mad. He determined to silence her at last. "One more question, and only one more. What is his father?" "His father," said Miss Abbott, "well, I don't suppose you'll think it a good match, but that's not the point. I mean, the point is not, I mean, that social differences, love, after all, not but what I—" Philip ground his teeth together and said nothing. "Gentlemen sometimes judge hardly, but I feel that you, and at all events your mother, so really good in every sense, so really unworldly, after all, love marriages are made in heaven." "Yes, Miss Abbott, I know, but I am anxious to hear heaven's choice. You arouse my curiosity. Is my sister-in-law to marry an angel?" "Mr. Herriton, don't. Please, Mr. Herriton. A dentist. His father's a dentist." Philip gave a cry of personal disgust and pain. He shuddered all over and edged away from his companion. "A dentist! A dentist at Monteriano! A dentist in Fairyland! False teeth and laughing gas and the tilting chair at a place which knew the Etruscan League and the Pax Romana and Alaric himself and the Countess Matilda and the Middle Ages all fighting in holiness, and the Renaissance all fighting in beauty." He thought of Lilia no longer. He was anxious for himself. He feared that romance might die. Romance only dies with life. No pair of pincers will ever pull it out of us. But there is a spurious sentiment which cannot resist the unexpected and the incongruous and the grotesque. A touch will loosen it, and the sooner it goes from us the better. It was going from Philip now, and therefore he gave a cry of pain. "I cannot think what is in the air," he began. "If Lilia was determined to disgrace us, she might have found a less repulsive way. A boy of medium height, with a pretty face, the son of a dentist at Monteriano. Have I put it correctly? May I surmise that he has not got one penny? May I also surmise that his social position is nil? Furthermore, stop, I'll tell you no more." "Really, Miss Abbott, it is a little late for reticence. You have equipped me admirably." "I'll tell you not another word," she cried with a spasm of terror. Then she got at her handkerchief, and seemed as if she would shed tears. After a silence which he intended to symbolize to her the dropping of a curtain on the scene, he began to talk of other subjects. They were among the olives again, and the wood with its beauty and wildness had passed away. But as they climbed higher the country opened out, and there appeared, high on a hill to the right, Monteriano. The hazy green of the olives rose up to its walls, and it seemed to float in isolation between trees and sky, like some fantastic ship city of a dream. Its color was brown, and it revealed not a single house, nothing but the narrow circle of the walls, and behind them 17 towers, all that was left of the 52 that had filled the city in her prime. Some were only stumps, some were inclining stiffly to their fall, some were still erect, piercing like masts into the blue. It was impossible to praise it as beautiful, but it was also impossible to damn it as quaint. Meanwhile, Philip talked continually, thinking this had to be great evidence of resource and tact. It showed Miss Abbott that he had probed her to the bottom, but was able to conquer his disgust, and by sheer force of intellect continued to be as agreeable and amusing as ever. He did not know that he talked a good deal of nonsense, and that by sheer force of his intellect was weakened by the sight of Monteriano, and by the thought of dentistry within those walls. The town above them swung to the left, to the right, to the left again, as the road wound upward through the trees, and the towers began to glow in the descending sun. As they drew near, Philip saw the heads of people gathering black upon the walls, and he knew well what was happening, how the news was spreading that a stranger was in sight, and the beggars were aroused from their content and bid to adjust their deformities. How the alabaster man was running for his wares, and the authorized guide running for his peaked cap, and his two cards of recommendation, one from Miss McGee, Maida Vale, the other less valuable, from an equerry to the Queen of Peru, how someone else was running to tell the landlady of the Stella d'Italia to put on her pearl necklace and brown boots and empty the slops from the spare bedroom, and how the landlady was running to tell Lilia and her boy that their fate was at hand. Perhaps it was a pity Philip had talked so profusely. He had driven Miss Abbott half-demented, but he had given himself no time to concert a plan. The end came so suddenly. They emerged from the trees onto the terrace before the walk, with the vision of half-Tuscany radiant in the sun behind them, and then they turned in through the Siena gate, and their journey was over. The Dogana men admitted them with an air of gracious welcome, and they clattered up the narrow dark street, greeted by that mixture of curiosity and kindness which makes each Italian arrival so wonderful. He was stunned and knew not what to do. At the hotel he received no ordinary reception. The landlady wrung him by the hand, one person snatched his umbrella, another his bag, people pushed each other out of his way. The entrance seemed blocked with a crowd. Dogs were barking, bladder whistles being blown, women waving their handkerchiefs, excited children screaming on the stairs, and at the top of the stairs was Lilia herself, very radiant, with her best blouse on. "Welcome," she cried, "welcome to Monteriano." He greeted her, for he did not know what else to do, and a sympathetic murmur rose from the crowd below. "You told me to come here," she continued, "and I don't forget it. Let me introduce Signor Carella." Philip discerned in the corner behind her a young man who might eventually prove handsome and well-made, but certainly did not seem so then. He was half enveloped in the drapery of a cold, dirty curtain, and nervously stuck out a hand, which Philip took and found thick and damp. There were more murmurs of approval from the stairs. "Well, Din-Din's nearly ready," said Lilia. "Your room's down the passage, Philip. You needn't go changing." He stumbled away to wash his hands, utterly crushed by her effrontery. "Dear Caroline," whispered Lilia as soon as he had gone, "what an angel you've been to tell him. He takes it so well. But you must have had a mauvais quart d'heure." Miss Abbott's long terror suddenly turned into acidity. "I've told nothing," she snapped. "It's all for you, and if it takes only a quarter of an hour, you'll be lucky." Dinner was a nightmare. They had the smelly dining-room to themselves. Lilia was very smart and vociferous. At the head of the table, Miss Abbott, also in her best, sat by Philip, looking to his irritated nerves more like the tragedy confidant every moment. That scion of the Italian nobility, Signor Carella, sat opposite. Behind him loomed a bowl of goldfish who swam round and round, gaping at the guests. The face of Signor Carella was twitching too much for Philip to study it, but he could see the hands, which were not particularly cleaned, and did not get cleaner by fidgeting amongst the shining slabs of hair. His starched cuffs were not clean either, and as for his suit, it had obviously been bought for the occasion as something really English, a gigantic check which did not even fit. His handkerchief he had forgotten, but never missed it, Altogether, he was quite unpresentable, and very lucky to have a father who was a dentist in Monteriano. And why, even Lilia! But as soon as the meal began, it furnished Philip with an explanation. For the youth was hungry, and his lady filled his plate with spaghetti, and when those delicious slippery worms were flying down his throat, his face relaxed, and became for a moment unconscious and calm. And Philip had seen that face before in Italy 100 times, seen it and loved it, for it was not merely beautiful, but it had the charm which is the rightful heritage of all who are born on that soil. But he did not want to see it opposite him at dinner. It was not the face of a gentleman. Conversation, to give it that name, was carried on in a mixture of English and Italian. Lilia had picked up hardly any of the latter language, and Signor Corella had not yet learnt any of the former. Occasionally Miss Abbott had to act as interpreter between the lovers, and the situation became uncouth and revolting in the extreme. Yet Philip was too cowardly to break forth and denounce the engagement. He thought he should be more effective with Lilia if he had her alone, and pretended to himself that he must hear her defense before giving judgment. Signor Corella, heartened by the spaghetti and the throat-rasping wine, attempted to talk, and looking politely towards Philip said, "England is a great country. The Italians love England, and the English." Philip, in no mood for international amenities, merely bowed. "Italy, too," the other continued a little resentfully, "is a great country. She has produced many famous men, for example Garibaldi and Dante. The latter wrote The Inferno, The Purgatorio, The Paradiso. The Inferno is the most beautiful." And with a complacent tone of one who has received a solid education, he quoted the opening lines, "Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita mi ritrovai per una selva oscura, che la derita via eras marita." A quotation which was more apt than he supposed. Lilia glanced at Philip to see whether he noticed that she was marrying no ignoramus. Anxious to exhibit all the good qualities of her betrothed, she abruptly introduced the subject of pallone, in which it appeared he was a proficient player. He suddenly became shy and developed a conceited grin, the grin of the village yokel whose cricket score is mentioned before a stranger. Philip himself had loved to watch pallone, that entrancing combination of lawn tennis and fives, but he did not expect to love it quite so much again. "Oh, look!" exclaimed Lilia, "the poor wee fish!" A starved cat had been worrying them all for pieces of the purple, quivering beef they were trying to swallow. Signor Corella, with the brutality so common in Italians, had caught her by the paw and flung her away from him. Now she had climbed up to the bowl and was trying to hook out the fish. He got up, drove her off, and finding a large glass stopper by the bowl, entirely plugged up the aperture with it. "But may not the fish die?" said Miss Abbott. "They have no air." "Fish live on water, not on air," he replied in a knowing voice, and sat down. Apparently he was at his ease again, for he took to spitting on the floor. Philip glanced at Lilia, but did not detect her wincing. She talked bravely till the end of the disgusting meal, and then got up, saying, "Well, Philip, I am sure you are ready for bye-bye. We shall meet at 12 o'clock lunch tomorrow, if we don't meet before. They give us café later in our rooms." It was a little too impudent. Philip replied, "I should like to see you now, please, in my room, as I have come all the way on business." He heard Miss Abbott gasp. Signor Corella, who was lighting a rank cigar, had not understood. It was as he expected. When he was alone with Lilia, he lost all nervousness. The remembrance of his long intellectual supremacy strengthened him, and he began volubly. "My dear Lilia, don't let's have a scene. Before I arrived, I thought I might have to question you. It is unnecessary. I know everything. Miss Abbott has told me a certain amount, and the rest I see for myself." "See for yourself?" she exclaimed, and he remembered afterwards that she had flushed crimson. "That he is probably a ruffian and certainly a cad." "There are no cads in Italy," she said quickly. He was taken aback. It was one of his own remarks, and she further upset him by adding, "He is the son of a dentist. Why not?" "Thank you for the information. I know everything, as I told you before. I am also aware of the social position of an Italian who pulls teeth in a minute provincial town." He was not aware of it, but he ventured to conclude that it was pretty low. Nor did Lilia contradict him, but she was sharp enough to say, "Indeed, Philip, you surprise me. I understood you went in for equality and so on." "And I understood that Signor Carella was a member of the Italian nobility." "Well, we put it like that in the telegram so as not to shock dear Mrs. Herriton. But it is true. He is a younger branch. Of course, families ramify, just as in yours there is your cousin Joseph." She adroitly picked out the only undesirable member of the Herriton clan. "Gino's father is courtesy itself and rising rapidly in his profession. This very month he leaves Monteriano and sets up at Poggibonsi. And for my own poor part, I think what people are is what matters, but I don't suppose you'll agree. And I should like you to know that Gino's uncle is a priest, the same as a clergyman at home." Philip was aware of the social position of an Italian priest, and said so much about it that Lily interrupted him with, "Well, his cousin's a lawyer at Rome." "What kind of lawyer?" "Why, a lawyer just like you are, except that he has lots to do and can never get away." The remark hurt more than he cared to show. He changed his method, and in a gentle, conciliating tone delivered the following speech. "The whole thing is like a bad dream, so bad that it cannot go on. If there was one redeeming feature about the man, I might be uneasy. As it is, I can trust to time. For the moment, Lilia, he has taken you in, but you will find him out soon. It is not possible that you, a lady, accustomed to ladies and gentlemen, will tolerate a man whose position is, well, not equal to the son of the servant's dentist in Coronation Place. I am not blaming you now, but I blame the glamour of Italy. I have felt it myself, you know, and I greatly blame Miss Abbott."
"Caroline? Why blame her? What's all this to do with Caroline?"
"Because we expected her to..." He saw that the answer would involve him in difficulties, and, waving his hand, continued, "So I am confident, and you and your heart agree, that this engagement will not last. Think of your life at home. Think of Irma. And I'll also say think of us, for you know, Lilia, that we count you more than a relation. I should feel I was losing my own sister if you did this, and my mother would lose a daughter." She seemed touched at last, for she turned away her face and said, "I can't break it off now." "Poor Lilia," said he, genuinely moved. "I know it may be painful, but I have come to rescue you, and, bookworm though I may be, I am not frightened to stand up to a bully. He's merely an insolent boy. He thinks he can keep you to your word by threats. He'll be different when he sees he has a man to deal with." What follows should be prefaced with some simile. The simile of a powder mine, a thunderbolt, an earthquake, for it blew Philip up in the air and flattened him on the ground and swallowed him up in the depths. Lilia turned on her gallant defender and said, "For once in my life I'll thank you to leave me alone. I'll thank your mother, too. For 12 years you've trained me and tortured me, and I'll stand it no more. Do you think I'm a fool? Do you think I never felt? Ah! When I came to your house a poor young bride, how you all looked me over, never a kind word, and discussed me, and thought I might just do. And your mother corrected me, and your sister snubbed me, and you said funny things about me to show how clever you were. And when Charles died, I was still to run in strings for the honor of your beastly family, and I was to be cooped up at Sawston and learn to keep house, and all my chances spoilt of marrying again. No thank you, no thank you. Bully? Insolent boy? Who is that, pray, but you? But thank goodness I can stand up against the world now, for I found Gino, and this time I marry for love." The coarseness and truth of her attack alike overwhelmed him, but her supreme insolence found him words, and he too burst forth. "Yes, and I forbid you to do it. You despise me, perhaps, and think I'm feeble, but you're mistaken. You are ungrateful and impertinent and contemptible, but I will save you in order to save Irma and our name. There is going to be such a row in this town that you and he'll be sorry you came to it. I shall shrink from nothing, for my blood is up. It is unwise of you to laugh. I forbid you to marry Carella, and I shall tell him so now." "Do!" she cried. "Tell him so now. Have it out with him. Gino, Gino, come in. Avanti. Fra Filippo forbids the banns." Gino appeared so quickly that he must have been listening outside the door. "Fra Filippo's blood's up. He shrinks from nothing. Oh, take care he doesn't hurt you." She swayed about in vulgar imitation of Philip's walk, and then with a proud glance at the square shoulders of her betrothed, flounced out of the room. Did she intend them to fight? Philip had no intention of doing so.
And no more, it seemed, had Gino, who stood nervously in the middle of the room with twitching lips and eyes. "Please sit down, Signor Carella," said Philip in Italian. "Mrs. Herriton is rather agitated, but there is no reason we should not be calm. Might I offer you a cigarette? Please sit down." He refused the cigarette and the chair and remained standing in the full glare of the lamp. Philip, not averse to such assistance, got his own face into shadow. For a long time he was silent. It might impress Gino, and it also gave him time to collect himself. He would not this time fall into the error of blustering, which he had caught so unaccountably from Lilia. He would make his power felt by restraint. Why, when he looked up to begin, was Gino convulsed with silent laughter? It vanished immediately, but he became nervous, and was even more pompous than he intended. "Signor Carella, I will be frank with you. I have come to prevent you marrying Mrs. Herriton, because I see you will both be unhappy together. She is English, you are Italian. She is accustomed to one thing, you to another. And, pardon me if I say it, she is rich and you are poor." "I'm not marrying her because she is rich," was the sulky reply. "I never suggested that for a moment," said Philip courteously. "You are honourable, I am sure, but are you wise? And let me remind you that we want her with us at home. Her little daughter will be motherless. Our home will be broken up. If you grant my request, we will earn our thanks. You will not be without a reward for your disappointment." "Reward? What reward?" He bent over the back of a chair and looked earnestly at Philip. They were coming to terms pretty quickly. "Poor Lilia." Philip said slowly, "What about 1,000 lire? His soul went forth into one exclamation, and then he was silent with gaping lips. Philip would have given double. He had expected a bargain. "You can have them tonight." He found words and said, "It is too late." "But why?" "Because." His voice broke. Philip watched his face, a face without refinement, perhaps, but not without expression, watched it quiver and reform and dissolve from emotion into emotion. There was avarice at one moment, and insolence, and politeness, and stupidity, and cunning, and let us hope that sometimes there was love. But gradually one emotion dominated, the most unexpected of all, for his chest began to heave, and his eyes to wink, and his mouth to twitch, and suddenly he stood erect and roared forth his whole being in one tremendous laugh. Philip sprang up, and Gino, who had flung wide his arms to let the glorious creature go, took him by the shoulders and shook him, and said, "Because we are married, 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 as soon as I knew you were coming. There was no time to tell you. Oh, oh, you have come all the way for nothing. Oh, and oh, your generosity." Suddenly he became grave and said, "Please pardon me. I am rude. I am no better than a peasant, and I..." Here he saw Philip's face, and it was too much for him. He gasped and exploded and crammed his hands into his mouth and spat them out in another explosion and gave Philip an aimless push which toppled him onto the bed. He uttered a horrified, "Oh!" and then gave up and bolted away down the passage, shrieking like a child to tell the joke to his wife. For a time Philip lay on the bed, pretending to himself that he was hurt grievously. He could scarcely see for temper, and in the passage he ran against Miss Abbott, who promptly burst into tears. "I sleep at the Globo," he told her, "and start for Sawston tomorrow morning early. He has assaulted me. I could prosecute him, but shall not." "I can't stop here," she sobbed. "I daren't stop here. You will have to take me with you." End of chapter 2 of Where Angels Fear to Tread by E. M. Forster. Chapter 3 Where Angels Fear to Tread by E. M. Forster. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. To find out more, or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Where Angels Fear to Tread by E. M. Forster. Chapter 3 Opposite the Volterra Gate of Monteriano, outside the city, is a very respectable whitewashed mud wall, with a coping of red crinkled tiles to keep it from dissolution. It would suggest a gentleman's garden if there was not in its middle a large hole, which grows larger with every rainstorm. Through the hole is visible, firstly, the iron gate that is intended to close it, secondly, a square piece of ground,
which, though not quite mud, is at the same time not exactly grass, and finally another wall, stone this time, which has a wooden door in the middle, and two wooden shuttered windows each side, and apparently forms the façade of a one-story house. This house is bigger than it looks, for it slides for two stories down the hill behind, and the wooden door, which is always locked, really leads into the attic. The knowing person prefers to follow the precipitous mule track round the turn of the mud wall tile so he can take the edifice in the rear. Then, being now on a level with the cellars, he lifts up his head and shouts. If his voice sounds like something light, a letter, for example, or some vegetables or a bunch of flowers, a basket is let out of the first-floor windows by a string into which he puts his burdens and departs. But if he sounds like something heavy, such as a log of wood or a piece of meat or a visitor, he is interrogated and then bidden or forbidden to ascend. The ground floor and the upper floor of that battered house are alike deserted, and the inmates keep the central portion, just as in a dying body all life retires to the heart. There is a door at the top of the first flight of stairs, and if the visitor is admitted, he will find a welcome which is not necessarily cold. There are several rooms, some dark and mostly stuffy, a reception room adorned with horsehair chairs, woolwork stools, and a stove that is never lit. German bad taste without German domesticity broods over that room. Also a living room which insensibly glides into a bedroom when the refining influence of hospitality is absent, and real bedrooms. And last, but not least, the loggia, where you can live day and night if you feel inclined, drinking vermouth and smoking cigarettes with leagues of olive trees and vineyards and blue-green hills to watch you. It was in this house that the brief and inevitable tragedy of Lilia's married life took place. She made Gino buy it for her because it was there she had first seen him sitting on the mud wall that faced the Volterra gate. She remembered how the evening sun had struck his hair and how he had smiled down at her, and being both sentimental and unrefined, was determined to have the man and the place together. Things in Italy are cheap for an Italian, and though he would have preferred a house in the Piazza, or better still, a house at Siena, or, bliss above bliss, a house at Leghorn, he did as she asked, thinking that perhaps she showed her good taste in preferring so retired an abode. The house was far too big for them, and there was a general concourse of his relatives to fill it up. His father wished to make it a patriarchal concern, where all the family should have their rooms and meet together for meals, and was perfectly willing to give up the new practice at Poggibonsi and preside. Gino was quite willing, too, for he was an affectionate youth who liked a large home circle, and he told it as a pleasant bit of news to Lilia, who did not attempt to conceal her horror. At once he was horrified, too, saw that the idea was monstrous, abused himself to her for having suggested it, rushed off to tell his father that it was impossible. His father complained that prosperity was already corrupting him and making him unsympathetic and hard. His mother cried. His sisters accused him of blocking their social advance. He was apologetic and even cringing until they turned on Lilia. Then he turned on them, saying that they could not understand, much less associate with, the English lady who was his wife, that there should be one master in that house, himself. Lilia praised and petted him on his return, calling him brave and a hero and other endearing epithets. But he was rather blue when his clan left Monteriano in much dignity, a dignity which was not at all impaired by the acceptance of a check. They took the check not to Poggibonsi, after all, but to Empoli, a lively, dusty town some 20 miles off. There they settled down in comfort, and the sisters said they had been driven to it by Gino. The check was, of course, Lilia's, who was extremely generous and was quite willing to know anybody, so long as she had not to live with them, relations-in-law being on her nerves. She liked nothing better than finding out some obscure and distant connection. There were several of them, and acting the lady bountiful, leaving behind her bewilderment and too often discontent. Gino wondered how it was that all his people, who had formerly seemed so pleasant, had suddenly become plaintive and disagreeable. He put it down to his lady wife's magnificence, in comparison with which all seemed common. Her money flew apace in spite of the cheap living. She was even richer than he expected, and he remembered with shame how he had once regretted his inability to accept the 1,000 lire that Philip Herriton offered him in exchange for her. It would have been a short-sighted bargain. Lilia enjoyed settling into the house, with nothing to do except give orders to smiling workpeople and a devoted husband as interpreter. She wrote a jaunty account of her happiness to Mrs. Herriton, and Harriet answered the letter, saying, 1. That all future communications should be addressed to the solicitors. 2. Would Lilia return an inlaid box which Harriet had lent her, but not given, to keep handkerchiefs and collars in? "Look what I am giving up to live with you," she said to Gino, never omitting to lay stress on her condescension. He took her to mean the inlaid box, and said that she need not give it up at all. "Silly fellow, no. I mean the life. Those Herritons are very well connected. They lead Sawston society. But what do I care as long as I have my silly fellow?" She always treated him as a boy, which he was, and as a fool, which he was not, thinking herself so immeasurably superior to him that she neglected opportunity after opportunity of establishing her rule. He was good-looking and indolent, therefore he must be stupid. He was poor, therefore he would never dare to criticize his benefactress. He was passionately in love with her, therefore she could do exactly as she liked. "It may be heaven below," she thought, "but it's better than Charles." And all the time the boy was watching her and growing up. She was reminded of Charles by a disagreeable letter from the solicitors, bidding her disgorge a large sum of money for Irma, in accordance with her late husband's will. It was just like Charles's suspicious nature to have provided against a second marriage. Gino was equally indignant, and between them they composed a stinging reply, which had no effect. He then said that Irma had better come out and live with them. "The air is good, so is the food. She'll be happy here, and we shall not have to part with the money." But Lilia had not the courage even to suggest this to the Herritons, and an unexpected terror seized her at the thought of Irma, or any English child, being educated at Monteriano. Gino became terribly depressed over the solicitor's letter, more depressed than she thought necessary. There was no more to do in the house, and he spent whole days in the loggia, leaning over the parapet or sitting astride it disconsolately. "Oh, you idle boy," she cried, pinching his muscles. "Go and play pallone." "I'm a married man," he answered, without raising his head. "I do not play games any more." "Go and see your friends, then." "I have no friends now." "Silly, silly, silly, you can't stop indoors all day." "I want to see no one but you." He spat onto an olive tree. "Now, Gino, don't be silly. Go and see your friends, and bring them to see me. We both of us like society." He looked puzzled, but allowed himself to be persuaded, went out, found that he was not as friendless as he supposed, and returned after several hours in altered spirits. Lilia congratulated herself on her good management. "I'm ready, too, for people now," she said. "I mean to wake you all up, just as I woke up Sawston. Let's have plenty of men, and make them bring their womenkind. I mean to have real English tea parties." "There is my aunt and her husband, but I thought you did not want to receive my relatives." "I never said such a—" "But you will be right," he said earnestly. "They are not for you. Many of them are in trade, and even we are little more. You should have gentlefolk and nobility for your friends." "Poor fellow," thought Lilia. "It is sad for him to discover that his people are vulgar." She began to tell him that she loved him just for his silly self, and he flushed and began tugging at his mustache. "But besides your relatives, I must have other people here. Your friends have wives and sisters, haven't they?" "Oh, yes, but of course I scarcely know them." "Not know your friends' people?" "Why, no. If they are poor and have to work for their living, I may see them, but not otherwise. Except—" He stopped. The chief exception was a young lady to whom he had once been introduced for matrimonial purposes, but the dowry had proved inadequate, and the acquaintance terminated. "How funny! But I mean to change all that. Bring your friends to see me, and I will make them bring their people." He looked at her rather hopelessly. "Well, who are the principal people here? Who leads society?" "The governor of the prison, he supposed, and the officers who assisted him." "Well, are they married?" "Yes." "There we are. Do you know them?" "Yes, in a way." "I see," she exclaimed angrily. "They look down on you, do they, poor boy?" "Wait," he assented. "Wait, I'll soon stop that. Now who else is there?" "The Marchese, sometimes, and the canons of the collegiate church." "Married?" "The canons," he began with twinkling eyes. "Oh, I forgot your horrid celibacy. In England they would be the centre of everything. But why shouldn't I know them? Would it make it easier if I called all round? Isn't that your foreign way?" He did not think it would make it easier. "But I must know someone. Who were the men you were talking to this afternoon?" Low-class men. He could scarcely recollect their names. "But, Gino, dear, if they're low-class, why did you talk to them? Don't you care about your position?" All Gino cared about at present was idleness and pocket-money, and his way of expressing it was to exclaim, "Oof, poof, how hot it is in here! No air, I sweat all over, I expire. I must cool myself, or I shall never get to sleep." In his funny, abrupt way he ran out onto the loggia, where he lay full length on the parapet, and began to smoke and spit under the silence of the stars. Lilia gathered somehow from this conversation that continental society was not the go-as-you-please thing she had expected. Indeed, she could not see where continental society was. Italy is such a delightful place to live in if you happen to be a man. There one may enjoy that exquisite luxury of socialism, that true socialism which is based not on equality of income or character, but on the equality of manners. In the democracy of the café, or the street, the great question of our life has been solved, and the brotherhood of man is a reality. But it's accomplished at the expense of the sisterhood of women. Why should you not make friends with your neighbor at the theater or in the train, when you know and he knows that feminine criticism and feminine insight and feminine prejudice will never come between you? Though you become as David and Jonathan, you need never enter his home nor he yours. All your lives you will meet under the open air, the only roof-tree of the South, under which he will spit and swear, and you will drop your H's, and nobody will think the worse of either. Meanwhile, the women, they have, of course, their house and their church, with its admirable and frequent services, to which they are escorted by the maid. Otherwise, they do not go out much, for it is not genteel to walk, and you are too poor to keep a carriage. Occasionally you will take them to the café or theatre, and immediately all your unwonted acquaintance there desert you, except those few who are expecting and expect to marry into your family. It is all very sad, but one consolation emerges. Life is very pleasant in Italy if you are a man. Hitherto Gino had not interfered with Lilia. She was so much older than he was, and so much richer, that he regarded her as a superior being who answered to other laws. He was not wholly surprised, for strange rumors were always blowing over the Alps of lands where men and women had the same amusements and interests. And he had often met that privileged maniac, the lady tourist, on her solitary walks. Lilia took solitary walks, too, and only that week a tramp had grabbed at her watch, an episode which is supposed to be indigenous in Italy, though really less frequent there than in Bond Street. Now that he knew her better, he was inevitably losing his awe. No one could live with her and keep it, especially when she had been so silly as to lose a gold watch and chain. As he lay thoughtful along the parapet, he realized for the first time the responsibilities of moneyed life. He must save her from dangers, physical and social. After all, she was a woman. And I, he reflected, though I am young, am at all events a man, and know what is right. He found her still in the living room combing her hair, for she had something of the slattern in her nature, and there was no need to keep up appearances. "You must not go out alone," he said gently. "It is not safe. If you want to walk, Perfetta shall accompany you." Perfetta was a widowed cousin, too humble for social aspirations, who was living with them as a factotum. "Very well," smiled Lilia, "very well," as if she were addressing a solicitous kitten. But for all that she never took a solitary walk again, with one exception, till the day of her death. Days passed, and no one called except poor relatives. She began to feel dull. Didn't he know the sindaco or the bank manager? Even the landlady of the Stella d'Italia would be better than no one. She, when she went into the town, was pleasantly received, but people naturally found a difficulty in getting on with the lady who could not learn their language. And the tea party, under Gino's adroit management, receded ever and ever before her. He had a good deal of anxiety over her welfare, for she did not settle down in the house at all. But he was comforted by a welcome and unexpected visitor. As he was going one afternoon for the letters—they were delivered at the door, but it took longer to get them at the office—someone humorously threw a cloak over his head, and when he disengaged himself he saw his very dear friend, Spiridione Tesi, of the custom-house at Chiasso, whom we not met for 2 years. What joy! What salutations! So that all the passers-by smile with approval on the amiable scene. Spiridione's brother was now station-master at Bologna, and thus he himself could spend his holiday travelling over Italy at the public expense. Hearing of Gino's marriage, he came to see him on his way to Siena, where lived his own uncle, lately moneyed too. "They all do it," he exclaimed, "myself excepted." He was not quite 23. "But tell me more. She is English. That is good, very good. An English wife is very good indeed. And is she rich?" "Immensely rich." "Blonde or dark?"
"Blonde."
"Is it possible?"
"It pleases me very much," said Gino simply. "If you remember, I always desired a blonde."
Three or four men had collected and were listening.
"We all desire ones," said Spiridione.
"But you, Gino, deserve your good fortune, for you are a good son, a brave man, and a true friend, and from the very first moment I saw you I wished you well."
"No compliments, I beg," said Gino, standing with his hands crossed on his chest and a smile of pleasure on his face. Spiridione addressed the other men, none of whom he had ever seen before.
"Is it not true? Does he not deserve this wealthy blonde?"
"He does deserve her," said all the men. "It is a marvelous land, where you love it or hate it." There were no letters, and of course they sat down at the Café Garibaldi by the Collegiate Church. Quite a good café, that, for so small a city. There were marble-top tables, and pillars terracotta below, and gold above, and on the ceiling was a fresco of the Battle of Solferino. One could not have desired a prettier room. They had vermouth and little cakes with sugar on the top, which they chose gravely at the counter, pinching them first to be sure they were fresh. And though vermouth is barely alcoholic, Spiridione drenched his with soda water to be sure that it should not get into his head. They were in high spirits, and elaborate compliments alternated curiously with gentle horseplay. But soon they put up their legs on a pair of chairs and began to smoke.
"Tell me," said Spiridione, "I forgot to ask, is she young?"
33.
"Ah, well, we cannot have everything. But you would be surprised. Had she told me 28, I should not have disbelieved her."
"Is she simpatica?"
Nothing will translate that word.
Gino dabbed at the sugar and said after a silence,
"Sufficiently so."
"It is a most important thing."
"She is rich, she is generous, she is affable, she addresses her inferiors without haughtiness." There was another silence.
"It is not sufficient," said the other. "One does not define it thus." He lowered his voice to a whisper. "Last month a German was smuggling cigars, the custom-house was dark, yet I refused because I did not like him. The gifts of such men do not bring happiness. Non era simpatico. He paid for every one, and the fine for deception besides." "Do you gain much beyond your pay?" asked Gino, diverted for an instant.
"I do not accept small sums now. It is not worth the risk. But the German was another matter."
"But listen, my Gino, for I am older than you and more full of experience. The person who understands us at first sight, who never irritates us, who never bores, to whom we can pour forth every thought and wish, not only in speech but in silence, that is what I mean by simpatico."
"There are such men, I know," said Gino, "and I have heard it said of children. But where will you find such a woman?"
"That is true. Here you are wiser than I. Sono poco simpatiche le donne, and the time we waste over them is much." He sighed dolefully, as if he found the nobility of his sex a burden. "One I have seen who may be so. She spoke very little, but she was a young lady, different to most. She, too, is English, the companion of my wife here." But Fra Filippo, the brother-in-law, took her back with him. I saw them start. He was very angry. Then he spoke of his exciting and secret marriage, and they made fun of the unfortunate Philip, who had traveled over Europe to stop it.
"I regret, though," said Gino, when they had finished laughing, "that I toppled him onto the bed. A great tall man, and when I am really amused, I am often impolite."
"You'll never see him again," said Spiridione, who carried plenty of philosophy about him, "and by now the scene will have passed from his mind. It sometimes happens that such things are recollected longest." "I shall never see him again, of course. But it is no benefit to me that he should wish me ill, and even if he has forgotten, I am still sorry that I toppled him onto the bed." So the talk continued, at one moment full of childishness and tender wisdom, the next moment scandalously gross. The shadows of the terracotta pillars lengthened, and tourists, flying through the Palazzo Pubblico opposite, could observe how the Italians wasted time. The sight of the tourist reminded Gino of something he might say. "I want to consult you, since you are so kind as to take an interest in my affairs. My wife wishes to take solitary walks." Spiridione was shocked. "But I have forbidden her." "Naturally. She does not yet understand. She asked me to accompany her sometimes, to walk without object. You know, she would like me to be with her all day." "I see, I see." He knitted his brows and tried to think how he could help his friend. "She needs employment. Is she a Catholic?" "No." "That is a pity. She must be persuaded. It will be a great solace to her when she is alone." "I am a Catholic, but of course I never go to church." "Of course not. Still, you might take her at first. That is what my brother has done with his wife at Bologna, and he has joined the Freethinkers. He took her once or twice himself, and now she has acquired the habit and continues to go without him." "Most excellent advice, and I thank you for it. But she wishes to give tea parties. Men and women together whom she has never seen." "Oh, the English! They are always thinking of tea. They carry it by the kilogram in their trunks, and they are so clumsy that they always pack it at the top. But it is absurd." "What am I to do about it?" "Do nothing. Or ask me." "Come," cried Gino, springing up. "She'll be quite pleased." The dashing young fellow colored crimson. "Of course I was only joking." "I know, but she wants me to take my friends. Come now, waiter." "If I do come," cried the other, "and take the tea with you, this bill must be my affair." "Certainly not. You're in my country." A long argument ensued, in which the waiter took part, suggesting various solutions. At last Gino triumphed. The bill came to 8 pence halfpenny, and a halfpenny for the waiter brought it up to 9 pence. Then there was a shower of gratitude on one side, and of deprecation on the other, and when courtesies were at their height, they suddenly linked arms and swung down the street, tickling each other with lemonade straws as they went. Lilia was delighted to see them, and became more animated than Gino had known her for a long time. The tea tasted of chopped hay, and they asked to be allowed to drink it out of a wine glass, and refused milk. But, as she repeatedly observed, this was something like. Spiridione's manners were very agreeable. He kissed her hand on introduction, and as his profession had taught him a little English, conversation did not flag. "Do you like music?" she asked. "Passionately," he replied. "I have not studied scientific music, but the music of the heart, yes." So she played on the humming piano very badly, and he sang not so badly. Gino got out a guitar and sang too, sitting out on the loggia. It was a most agreeable visit. Gino said he would just walk his friend back to his lodgings. As they went, he said, without the least trace of malice or satire in his voice, "I think you are quite right. I shall not bring people to the house any more. I do not see why an English wife should be treated differently. This is Italy." "You are very wise," exclaimed the other. "Very wise indeed. The more precious a possession, the more carefully it should be guarded." They had reached the lodging, but went on as far as the Café Garibaldi, where they spent a long and most delightful evening. End of Chapter 3, Where Angels Fear to Tread, by E. M. Forster.
Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up, you get early payout on parlays too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.